What could you buy with $230,000? Think about that for a second. A house? A brand new Ferrari? A championship racehorse? $230,000 is a huge amount of money. That's how much Donald Trump's Save America PAC has spent per day on the former president's legal bills in February. $5.6 million in 1 month, which I should note is more than the PAC was able to raise over that same period. Everybody knows that the one thing Donald Trump needs right now is money. When Trump engineered his takeover of the RNC earlier this month, his top advisor, Chris LaCivita, promised that not a penny, quote, of the RNC's money would go to pay the president's legal fees. He said that the RNC is as much a part of the Trump campaign as the Trump campaign is part of the RNC. His words. Okay. Important words, because tonight we're learning new details about the Trump campaign's new deal with the RNC. The unusual arrangement prioritizes Trump's Save America PAC over the RNC. So while the RNC funds don't go directly to pay Trump's lawyers, any donation to the combined entity go to Trump's campaign and his Save America PAC first. Then the remainder goes to the RNC. And boy, he's going to need it. Because Trump's legal woes are far from over, there's no telling what amount of legal fees he'll continue to accrue over the next year with four criminal trials still looming. And then there's the money he owes for trials that are already over. The $464 million bond from Trump's civil fraud trial in New York is due on Monday, 4 days from now. Not to mention the fact that $500 million is accruing $100,000 worth of interest every 24 hours. Trump's attorneys have said that securing the bond is a, quote, practical impossibility, end quote. Failure to come up with a bond means that the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, can start the process of seizing the former president's assets as early as next week. Of course, there is another option for Trump, which could delay having to pay by months or even years. Declare bankruptcy. Trump is reportedly not even considering bankruptcy as an option. Why would he be? He's already done it six times before, by the way. What's one more bankruptcy on the pile, especially when the former president is strapped for cash? Well, it seems that Donald's money woes may have finally become a political liability. According to the Washington Post, Trump doesn't want to declare bankruptcy, partially out of concern that it could damage his campaign to recapture the White House from President Biden in November, end quote. Trump is worried about the optics of bankruptcy because it cuts to the heart of his identity. The Donald built his brand on being rich, on living a lavish lifestyle that the rest of us wish we could live. He started a TV show where his theme song was money. He surrounded himself with products that signify extravagant luxury, casinos, steaks, high-rise apartment buildings. He built his 2016 campaign on the idea that he was so rich he couldn't be bought, symbolically riding into the 2000 race on a golden elevator.
Our country needs a truly great leader, and we need a truly great leader now. We need a leader that wrote the art of the deal. I don't need anybody's money. It's nice. I don't need anybody's money. I'm using my own money. I'm not using the lobbyists. I'm not using donors. I don't care. I'm really rich. I'll show you that in a second.
Really rich. That was then, this is now. Trump not only finds himself in panic mode as he tries to secure a nearly $500 million bond, with the general election starting, he also has to worry about what voters will think about his very real money problems. And his opponent is not helping. When it comes to fundraising, President Biden has been consistently outpacing Trump, widening the gap between them last month. In February, Biden raised over $20 million. All told, the combined cash on hand for the Biden campaign and the DNC totaled over $97 million, which is more than double the combined cash held by the Trump campaign and the RNC. This suddenly looks like a vulnerable moment for Donald Trump, and it appears that Team Biden is prepared to take advantage of it. Not only are they planning a major ad blitz with their fundraising cash, but perhaps more importantly, President Biden has started to take some direct shots at Trump's money troubles. When it comes to Trump's legal woes, Joe Biden has refused to comment. But Trump's financial issues? Apparently, those are fair game. At a closed-door fundraiser with Democratic donors in Dallas last night, Biden joked, quote, I know not everyone is feeling the enthusiasm. Just the other day, a defeated-looking man came up to me and said, Mr. President, I have crushing debt, and I'm completely wiped out. And I had to look at him and say, Donald, I'm sorry. I can't help you, end quote. Biden has now trotted out this joke three times in the past 24 hours, signaling that it might be the start of a new, more aggressive strategy for the White House. For decades, Donald Trump overinflated his wealth and he got away with it. And now he's starting to pay for it. Suddenly, what Trump has always touted as his greatest strength now seems like a glaring weakness. And Democrats seem ready to pounce. Joining us now, Tim O'Brien, senior executive editor of Bloomberg Opinion, author of Trump Nation, The Art of Being the Donald. For that, he was sued by Donald Trump, by the way, and he won. Also with me, Robert Gibbs, former White House secretary for President Obama, press secretary for President Obama, and now an MSNBC political analyst. Gentlemen, good to see you both. Thank you for being with us. Tim O'Brien, let's talk about the part of this that is interesting. Guys like you have spent a lot of time figuring out Donald Trump, what he's worth, what his cash position is. But the Attorney General of New York and this court case have done that. They have roadmapped it. They know what he's worth. And this is a real problem. The truth about the Donald Trump myth came out in this trial and is now being solidified by the fact that he can't raise this bond.
And some of those myths are being burst in very useful ways. You know, I think one of the things that confounded people during Trump's first term, there was this idea that he has always existed beyond the reach of the law, that he had, you know, nine legal lives and he only gone through one of them. And I think you're now seeing, at least on a financial basis, he is getting exposed for decades of what he's been doing, which is inflating, lying, exaggerating, however you want to describe it, how much money he has and what he does with his money. And I think that's one of the things that's gnawing at him more than almost anything else in this current round, is that the emperor has no financial clothing. He said in a deposition a year ago that he had $400 million in cash on hand, and he was adding to that amount on a monthly basis in significant ways. He either lied under oath, either perjured himself in that deposition.
Or he's a really bad businessman.
Or he's a really bad businessman, or he blew through that money somehow magically over the last year, or he doesn't want to touch it because he wants to lay these debts off on perhaps people donating to his campaign. For whatever reason, that money, he says, isn't there now.
Right.
And so he's going to have to rely on the good graces of other people. And he doesn't have a lot of options. There's talk that he's going to seek bankruptcy protection. I think we would have already gotten some indications of that. It would have to be a very complex filing. I think Letitia James is waiting to attach his assets on Monday.
Right.
She's been very sharp, I think, about specifically naming some of the properties that she would want
like
to attach.
Like 40 Wall Street, which he said he wouldn't even know what it is.
That's right. You know, the reality is there are certain properties that he deeply prizes. You know, in the early 90s, when he went through those six corporate bankruptcies, he came within an inch of personal bankruptcy, but for a piece of his father's estate that his siblings gave him so he could stay solvent. Otherwise, he would have gone under personally too. And at that time, he basically got on his knees to his bankers and said, take whatever you want, but don't take my condo and don't take Mar-a-Lago.
Right.
And I think that the Attorney General's office is very hip to the idea that there are certain toys that are more valuable to Trump than others. And I think that's got to be gnawing at him as well. But there's going to be a resolution of some sort around this on Monday. Either the appellate court's going to step in and say he gets extra time, or that maybe he gets to play some shenanigans around what he posts, though I would be surprised by that. I don't see a bankruptcy filing coming, but maybe it will. Even if he does a bankruptcy filing, he's going to have very detailed proclamations within the filing about his assets, the debts held against those assets. Again, a kind of public revelation of what he has that he's never wanted to do. Because, of course, what it will show in the end is a guy who said when he launched his campaign in 2015, I'm really rich. I'm worth $10 billion. I'm worth $8 billion. I'm worth six. These are all the numbers. He's nowhere close to those numbers.
Right.
And he doesn't really want to pop his own balloon in that regard, but he's probably going to be forced to.
Robert Gibbs, Donald Trump has said so many things about democracy and what he would do about it if he were elected. You would think that would be enough. And Joe Biden has really leaned into the idea that this is a choice between a presidency that continues democracy and a president that perhaps undermines it both in the United States and abroad. You would think that would be enough, but apparently it's not. And so Joe Biden has decided that this is the soft underbelly that he can go after. Tell me what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, well, look, I think, as Tim just said, the whole notion of Donald Trump's wealth and this myth of job creation and all of the things that have gone with sort of who Donald Trump is for a long time is on the verge of being pierced. I mean, this is central to that narrative. It's central to, quite frankly, the way voters began to see him as somebody who was a nifty negotiator, somebody who understood business, and that, quite frankly, he was wealthy because of all his business acumen, and that would be something that would be a bonus to have somebody in the White House that could do all that. Obviously, a lot of that was built on myth to begin with. This is beginning to crumble in front of Donald Trump's eyes through the courts, through campaign fundraising. And look, I think the Biden campaign senses it's an interesting moment to go after not just who voters think Donald Trump is, but really to press the advantage with campaign finance amounts. It's really stunning to watch the presumptive nominee be outraised by the Democratic nominee, in this case, 2-1, to have that money gap become wider month after month after month. It's been a long time since we've been through certainly a presidential campaign where there was a distinct disadvantage on one side with money. And right now, Donald Trump is very much approaching this campaign as if he's going to have that distinct disadvantage. Low dollar donors are weary. They're tired of being asked. And those high dollar donors are worried more and more, quite frankly, that the money they give is going to be part of the $80 million that's already gone to pay his lawyers.
But let me ask you this, Robert. Joe Biden has been fairly judicious about not wading into Trump's other legal problems. He just doesn't want to do it because Donald Trump tells every court who will listen that his prosecution is at the hands of his political opponent, Joe Biden. Joe Biden never comments on it, but he does comment on this. Obviously, it's fair game because it's adjudicated.
Yeah, and I think it's smart. Look, Joe Biden is his administration obviously runs the Department of Justice. I think staying out of those legal comments is smart. I think this. I think you know who he is and who his business is, and his money in this case is different, and it's much more fair game.
Tim, is anything here surprising to you? I mean, this that he had $400 million on hand, or at least that's what he testified, and maybe he was lying, or he's lost the money. Whatever the case is, does this fundamentally surprise you, or is this where you thought Donald Trump was in the world?
Well, I mean, I'm only surprised at how he is willing to take this particular judgment to the cliff. Mm-hmm. You know, you would have thought, given the financial stakes that are involved, the possible revelations that are involved, how central his both his insecurities and his myths are to saying I'm a billionaire, that he would let it get to a place where he'd be exposed like this.
But doesn't that suggest to you that he really can't raise that bond?
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. And I think that, and that's why I also think he would have gotten a bankruptcy proceeding going sooner if he was trying to forestall this. And I think what it's now emerging, I think on Monday it could be something of a car crash. And he had to have lawyers telling him weeks ago that you should prep for something like this.
Right.
And he ignored them as he always does. And again, it's that he's allowing these existential cataclysms to be visited upon him because he's an undisciplined 7-year-old. He is not an adult. He's not a rational adult. He's a dangerous politician, and he's willing to play with fire around his own finances in order to score sort of performance acting and performance art results in the courts and in the media, but it's not good for his business, and it's becoming increasingly bad for his political life.
It's going to be interesting. Monday is going to be a day not to be out of the news.
It's a reckoning.
Watch what it's going to be, a reckoning. Guys, thank you very much. Tim O'Brien is the senior executive editor, Bloomberg Opinion. Robert Gibbs is a former White House press secretary. Thank you both, gentlemen, for your time tonight. We've got much more ahead this evening, including what's going on with the judge presiding over Trump's classified docs case, why her latest moves have legal experts questioning her motives yet again. But first, after blocking three UN resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, the U.S. is now putting its own ceasefire resolution up for a vote before the UN Security Council tomorrow morning. What's behind the shift? That's next.
Alpha 1-9er, commence Wi-Fi device checklist.
Laptops on. TVs streaming. Game console consoling. Smart thermostat set for cuddle time. Doorbell camera. Oh, my package is here.
Fast, reliable, able to power tons of devices inside your home at once.
All systems go, you are clear for takeoff.
This is Xfinity Internet, Wi-Fi built to wow. And watch the short film, The Aviators, now playing at Xfinity.com. Restrictions apply. Actual speeds vary and are not guaranteed.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
The result of the voting is as follows. 13 votes in favor, 1 vote against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has not been adopted owing to the negative vote of a permanent member of the council.
The draft resolution has not been approved due to the veto of a permanent member of the Security Council.
The draft resolution has not been adopted owing to the negative vote of a permanent member of the Council.
Since the war in Gaza began, there have been 3 attempts by the United Nations Security Council to call for a ceasefire or to condemn civilian casualties in Gaza. Each time, the United States has used its veto power to block those resolutions. But now, that is changing. Tomorrow morning, for the first time, the United States will introduce its own resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Unlike previous resolutions, the U.S. has conditioned its call for a ceasefire on the immediate release of all of the hostages being held by Hamas in Gaza. But it is still a remarkable change in the U.S. position. It comes as we are learning that the Republican Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, plans to make an end run around the Biden administration and invite the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to address Congress about the war. The Biden administration is increasing its pressure on the Netanyahu government at the same time that the Netanyahu government is aligning itself much more closely with Biden's political opponents, with Republicans. Joining us now is the Senator, Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut and a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator, it's good to see you again. Thank you so much. 2015 was the last time this happened, and it happened very similarly. Netanyahu cut a deal with Republicans to address Congress in what was largely seen as an affront to Barack Obama. Exactly the same thing is happening right now. Netanyahu is going to Congress at the behest of Republicans, possibly, in an end run against his deteriorating relationship with Joe Biden. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure that I see it as an apples to apples comparison. Netanyahu was coming at that moment to object to a very specific and top priority policy for the Obama administration.
The Iran,
the nuclear
nuclear
agreement
deal.
With Iran, right? Yeah, this is a different moment where the eyes of the world are on Israel. And I think it is important for the Israeli leader to come to the United States and explain to Congress what the Israeli policy is and why this campaign in Gaza, which has now, you know, killed tens of thousands of civilians, is actually going to eradicate a terrorist threat to Israel and to the United States. So I don't like when Netanyahu, you know, talks only to Republicans. I think that that's really bad for the U.S.-Israeli relationship. But given that the eyes of the world are on Israel today, I actually think it may benefit all of us to have him come and make the case to both Democrats and Republicans. See, there will be many that will object to the case he makes, but it's probably best to air that out in the open.
What happens? Play that out for me. There's, as you said, a reasonable expectation that many will object to it. Nobody's going to have their minds changed, probably. So what happens then? He comes, people air their grievances. There is still a pending attack on Rafah. There is still the death of 30,000 Palestinians. There is still a Biden administration that is in disagreement with the Netanyahu administration. So what do you think happens next?
Well, listen, I'm not sure that his speech before Congress will have a material effect on people's views, but I don't know that we should be afraid of listening to the Israeli leader, even if we disagree with him. I mean, listen, I have come to the conclusion that there needs to be an immediate pause to hostilities. I would not condition it upon the release of the hostages. I hope that there is an agreement between Hamas and Israel with intermediaries that allows for the release of the hostages. But I think that the humanitarian situation on the ground is so dire today with famine lurking that Israel needs to stop military operations right now and focus on restoring order and combating famine. That's my position. The administration takes a different position that they will articulate at the UN tomorrow. I don't think my position will be changed by Netanyahu's appearance, but I don't know that we should block him from coming and explaining his position. We're a body that welcomes open dialogue, and we should have that dialogue even with leaders that we don't have full agreement with.
That's a good point. Secretary Blinken in the Middle East, he's hopeful for the concept of a ceasefire that you talk about. Increasingly, the calls for that are growing. It is a remarkable moment that in the morning, the United States will call for that. Conditioned or not, it's a major move for the United States in the history of U.S.-Israeli relations. Are you hopeful that we're getting closer? I fully understand that pressure is growing on Israel to do it. But are you hopeful that that pressure gets us anywhere? Because Benjamin Netanyahu is basically campaigning in an election that he's not running in about the fact that he is the only one who can stand up to America as if America is the problem for Israel.
Listen, of course, I am hopeful. But, you know, every day that goes by without an agreement, I think, should make us all more worried. Both sides are going to have to not allow the perfect to be the enemy of the good. And I think many of us worry, and you heard Senator Schumer articulate this a few days ago, that Netanyahu is making decisions not necessarily in accordance with what's best for Israeli security or American security, but what is best for his political future. The longer the war goes on, the more likely it is that the war cabinet holds and he stays in power. When the war ends or when there is a long-term pause, there certainly will be a discussion inside Israel as to whether to move forward with elections. And I think that that is a very real worry at this moment, thinking about the motivations that the Netanyahu government has when it's making decisions on the ground in Gaza.
Senator, I want to ask you about a completely unrelated topic. This is what we call in the business a hard turn, but it actually is kind of interesting. It's about our phones. The Justice Department is suing Apple for allegedly abusing monopoly power in the phone-based app market. You tweeted today, people feel powerless and alone when companies this big have so much power over their lives. For a lot of people, they're not sure how to think about this because we all live in this Apple walled garden. So we're not sure. I mean, it's kind of our lives. Are we mad at them? What should they be doing differently? What's your take on this?
Yeah, listen, we have that relationship with Apple. We have that relationship with Google. We have that relationship with Amazon, right? We get tremendous benefit from these services. The problem is their non-competitive monopolistic practices happen behind a wall that we don't see. And so we end up paying far more for these services, for instance, the apps on our iPhone, and we get a much lower quality experience. For instance, on the iPhone, the inability to play cloud-based games, because that would actually harm Apple's market, which forces you to buy more computing power on your phone because you can't get access to the cloud. And so it's very right for the government to be stepping up and saying, whether or not we see these monopolistic practices, they're illegal. And I do think that Americans feel that they have lost an amount of power because Apple and Amazon and Google have so much market share that we have no ability to really compete their services against anyone else. And we would all be paying a lot less for the services that they provide if we forced them into a competitive market. And so this is a really important action that the Department of Justice is taking against Apple. It stands next to actions that have been taken against Google and Amazon. And I'm so glad that the Biden administration is making it a priority to break up these big monopoly powers, especially in big tech. Donald Trump talks a big game about coming after big tech. So do many Republicans, but they don't do it. They don't do it. They end up just passing policies that further enriches the bottom lines of these companies. Joe Biden is actually coming after these big companies to break up their power.
Yeah, it's a big signal when the government will actually say to people, you've got too much power over the consumer. You may be a good company. You may be bringing value to the consumer. These things definitely, as you said, bring value to our lives to have access to them. But it does take away some choice. It does take away some opportunity for us to make choices. Senator, good to see you. Thank you, as always. Senator Chris Murphy is a Democrat of Connecticut. He's a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Thank you for your time tonight, sir. When we come back, Donald Trump says the quiet part out loud about the Republican Party and reproductive freedom. Plus, the judge overseeing the prosecution of Donald Trump over the classified documents that he hid in Mar-a-Lago is raising new alarm bells among court watchers. We'll have more on that just ahead.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com. Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
It's been 20 days since the judge in the classified documents case, Judge Aileen Cannon, held a hearing to discuss a possible new trial date. The special counsel, Jack Smith, is hoping that it'll go to trial this summer. Donald Trump is hoping that it'll go to trial never. And nearly 3 weeks later, Judge Cannon has yet to make a decision on the matter. She has found time, however, to hold a separate hearing on a couple of Donald Trump's motions to dismiss the case. She dismissed one of them the same day, kind of. She shot down Trump's request to dismiss the charges against him based on unconstitutional vagueness, but she also left the door open to bring that idea back at trial. Then, in an order Judge Cannon issued this week, she appears to be engaging with Trump's other motion to dismiss this case. This one based on his claim that he had the right under the Presidential Records Act to keep classified documents. Judge Cannon has given lawyers on both sides another couple of weeks to submit proposed jury instructions about that question. And that has raised eyebrows among legal experts who are watching this case closely, some of whom are describing Judge Cannon's order with words like insane. Joining me now, Mary McCord, former senior Justice Department official and co-host of the Prosecuting Donald Trump podcast. Mary, good evening to you. I don't have any legal education. I find this a little hard to follow. She has asked both sides to come up with I don't know, draft jury questions or instructions about matters relating to Donald Trump's claim. I didn't know that that happens. It doesn't happen all that much in Law and Order. So help us make sense of it.
So, you know, judges do ask the parties for proposed jury instructions. They don't do that many, many months before a trial that has not even been scheduled yet. They do that when we're on the eve of trial. In fact, oftentimes they do that in the midst of trial. They'll ask the parties, given, you know, how the evidence has come out, to propose jury instructions. This is not even about the real proposed jury instructions. She's made that clear. There'll be a later time for this. This is like an exercise she's putting the government and Mr. Trump's attorneys to, which is like, hypothesize with me here these two competing scenarios, neither one of which has any basis of in law, but do make us wonder if she isn't trying to push decisions she should be making, legal decisions she should be making right now, push those to the time of a jury, and asking things like, suppose, should it be the jury who looks at each document and decides, did the government prove it's personal or presidential? Now, the definition of presidential records are records that are prepared for the president or by his staff for him in executing his constitutional, statutory, or other official or ceremonial duties. Personal records are the opposite of that, things that are personal, purely personal, not for executing constitutional or statutory duties. And of course, these are original classified documents by the intelligence community. So clearly, you know, presidential records that are provided to the president when he was the president in order for him to carry out his constitutional or statutory duties. But she neglects all of that, posits in these competing scenarios, one in which the jury would decide whether these are presidential or personal, the other in which the jury, I think, would only decide was Mr. Trump designating them personal by not returning them to the archives. Just simply by not returning them, did that mean they're personal? So she's skipping over the legal decisions that she has been asked to make in these motions to dismiss, and suggesting she's going to leave some issues to the jury that really should not be jury issues.
And that's exactly the part that has those of us who don't understand the law scratching our heads, right? The second question that she asks, the second jury instruction that she's asking the two legal teams about, reads as follows. A president has sole authority under the Presidential Records Act to categorize records as personal or presidential during his or her presidency. Neither a court nor a jury is permitted to make or review such a categorization decision. This is what you were talking about, but I wanted to read it for the viewer so they know what we're talking about. This seems like a very, very big deal, and it seems like a very, very big legal deal that speaks to the merits of this case. This doesn't feel like a sort of a casual thing you put to a jury before you have a jury.
That's right. And, you know, other government arguments the government made that she just hasn't dealt with are things like the Presidential Records Act has absolutely nothing to do with the criminal charges against him, which are under criminal United States Code provisions that say you cannot retain national defense information when you're not authorized to have it and you have been asked to return it. And that issue is completely separate from personal or presidential. And as we've already discussed, there's no real world in which these documents are personal records. And the danger here, Ali, is that if she lets this go to trial, she could actually take the issue away from the jury. She could do something called grant a motion for a judgment of acquittal, a Rule 29 motion at the end of the government's case, and just say, I'm finding the government didn't prove that these were not personal records, and I'm directing a judgment of acquittal. And that is something that the government cannot appeal. It's just as though a jury had found somebody not guilty, and the government can't appeal that. So I think a lot of people looking at this are feeling very skeptical about what are her motives here, and why is she not dealing with the legal issues the way she was asked to do? Why is she suggesting that she's going to push things off to the trial? Could be she won't do that. Could be she would leave it to a jury. But that's also dangerous because these are really legal questions. And she's assuming those responses and not engaging with the government's arguments.
Mary, I knew you'd make me understand this better, and I appreciate that. Thank you so much. Mary McCord is a former senior Justice Department official and the co-host of the Prosecuting Donald Trump podcast. Thank you, as always, for joining us. Coming up, if you thought the overturning of Roe v. Wade would be enough to satiate conservatives and their assault on women's reproductive rights, think again. Evidence of the dystopian direction that things appear to be headed is up next. Less than 2 years ago, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham made his fellow conservatives clutch their pearls when he introduced a bill that would ban abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy across the country. At the time, it was unthinkable. It was way out there. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell refused to answer questions about it. He said most Republican senators, quote, prefer this be handled at the state level, end quote. Senator John Cornyn of Texas insisted that this wasn't a, quote, conference decision and that Graham had gone rogue. Graham's bill was untouchable, third rail. It went nowhere until now.
The number of weeks now, people are agreeing on 15, and I'm thinking in terms of that, and it'll come out to something that's very reasonable.
Democrats are the radicals on this issue because it's okay to have an abortion in 7, 8, 9 months, and even after birth, according to that.
Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for president, wants a national 15-week abortion ban, what Lindsey Graham suggested, something that would apply to every state, including states that have enshrined the right to abortion in their state constitutions. And he calls this, quote, very reasonable. He says Democrats, the ones who support access to abortion, are radicals. This is a pattern in the conservative movement now that Roe is gone. They are shifting the middle ground. What was fringe and unthinkable 2 years ago is now marketed as moderate. Upending access to in vitro fertilization, for example, was considered unimaginable until Alabama's Supreme Court did it last month. If you think there's a reproductive freedom that is so socially protected that conservatives could never touch it, think again. For example, here's right-wing pundit Ben Shapiro last year.
It's almost a political third rail that if you mention that there are side effects to taking the birth control pill, which, by the way, many of these have been known about for a very long time. Like, they're listed among the side effects. But if you talk about this, then somehow it means that you are sort of an uber religious fanatic.
That's how he introduced a guest on his radio show who was there to warn the American public about the perils of hormonal birth control.
There's a breadth of impacts that it has, including partner selection. They've found that women who are on the birth control pill tend to be attracted to men that are less traditionally masculine, which is certainly interesting and might have societal impacts.
Women who are on the birth control pill are attracted to men who are less traditionally masculine. I don't even know what to make of that. This year, this is what young women and teens are hearing online.
Having a period is so stupid, so I just take birth control and skip the placebo. What? I used to do that too, and now I just can't believe how brainwashed we've been as women.
Birth control gave me blood clots.
The truth is birth control is going to give you a whole lot of symptoms. So how about instead we teach our women how to live in tune with their cycles?
Fun fact, you are only fertile for 24 hours each month.
Your body tells you when you're fertile and when you're not.
If you are team them kids, but you're also team, I'm not trying to take that birth control because it, you know, it's bad for you. Keep watching this video. Listen to me. Neem leaf capsules. When I tell y'all that this works, babe, period. On time. Every time.
There's now a world of influencers on social media cautioning women against hormonal birth control and marketing what they say are replacement products. Some of them are presenting themselves as medical experts. Most of them are not. But these influencers are gaining clicks and followers while contributing to a new medically questionable yet lucrative industry focused on naturally regulating hormones. According to the Washington Post, some of this is backed by some pretty prominent conservatives, like the Republican donor Peter Thiel, who's reportedly invested in a menstrual cycle tracking app called 28. And the online messaging may be helping conservatives push legislation to limiting access to birth control. And as access to birth control for minors is actually being litigated in the country's courts. It might be unthinkable now, but with a strong enough influencer marketing campaign, the far right might eventually be able to control nearly every aspect of women's reproductive health care. Because that's essentially what all of this is about. Control. Very reasonable. Control. I'm going to talk about that with Mini Timaraju of Reproductive Freedom for All after the break. Since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, giving individual states the option to exercise control over their citizens' reproductive freedom, 21 states across the country have either banned abortion outright or severely restricted the procedure. In Louisiana, abortion is banned in almost all circumstances, even in cases of rape and incest. However, abortion is allowed when the life of the pregnant person is in danger. But here's the thing. The state of Louisiana is very unclear about when that exception applies. The obscurity forces doctors to question what qualifies as an exception and what does not. Will I be prosecuted for saving this person's life? This is not hyperbole. According to a new report, doctors in Louisiana are delaying necessary reproductive health care, including treatment for ectopic pregnancies, a condition that, if not immediately treated, can be deadly, out of fear of breaking the current law, which could land them up to 15 years in prison, $200,000 in fines, and a loss of their medical license. In one case, a patient said her care was delayed for so long that her fallopian tubes ruptured. I could have died, she said in the report. I really could have died. Joining me now is Mini Timaraju, president and CEO of Reproductive Freedom for All. Mini, good to see you. Thank you for being with us. You know, I was one of those dupes who thought this was about abortion and whether you believe in a human life and when it starts. And, you know, I thought these were for a little while good faith beliefs. It's fully about control. It's full, the IVF stuff, the idea that you can't be clear about who qualifies for an abortion in the case of rape and incest. It's really just about control.
You know, I was with a couple of hundred supporters today at an event in California, and we were really digging into this exact issue, Ali, that we know it wasn't that long ago that women in this country couldn't buy property or get a credit card without the control of their spouse, right? Without the authorization of their spouse. There were women in that room who I was meeting with today, who are supporters of our org, who remember those days. It wasn't that long ago, you know? It was when our mothers were working in the workforce for the first time. It's when birth control became widely available in society. And the fact that society has so fundamentally shifted since women got into the workforce is directly tied to the birth control pill. Reproductive freedom has always been at the core of women's economic and social mobility. So it's important to understand that that is 100% why there are conservative forces in this country that want to push us back into the shadows. And it is 100% about power control. And we don't have to go that far back into history to make the connection.
There was a report about what's going on in Louisiana. There are descriptions of times in which doctors, instead of prescribing mifepristone, are performing cesarean sections on women, which is wild. Performing a surgery on a woman. The quote here is that the doctor, ended up having to take this person for C-section to preserve the appearance of not doing an abortion, even though this is not a viable pregnancy.
This is the dystopian situation that the Trump Supreme Court has wrought on this country. You know, we've been talking about this since Dobbs happened, that this was the natural outcome that would happen in states where we've banned abortion and made incredibly hostile conditions for providers. We knew this was going to happen. It's happening in real time. I'm so grateful that you're covering it. We have to keep telling these stories. And we know they disproportionately affect women of color who are the most at the margins in places like Louisiana.
Mini, we have much more to talk about. I'm out of time for the show, but you and I talk regularly, and we will continue to have this conversation. Thank you always for your time. Mini Timaraju is the president and CEO of Reproductive Freedom for All. That's our show for tonight.